This is Reset on 91.5 WBEZ. I'm Justin Kaufman. Our next guest is one of America's finest authors working today. Writer Isabel Wilkerson won a Pulitzer Prize for The Warmth of Other Suns, published back in 2010. It was a book about something near and dear to Chicagoans, the Great Migration. Wilkerson knows Chicago. She was once a Chicago bureau chief for the New York Times. Wilkerson's back with a new book called Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents. It explores race and racism through the lens of American hierarchy. Our country's caste system has been designed since day one and continues to be used as a way to keep certain people at the top and others at the bottom. It's a story of how our country that's equal parts surprising and at times ugly. It explores how we have not only used the caste system to keep people down, but how we've become the gold standard in the world for it. Nazi Germany, they studied how the South treated black people after slavery to inform their plans to isolate Jews. As Wilkerson points out in the book, America is like an old house. You and I may have not built that house, but it's where we live now, and we need to fix it up. An outstanding book. Author Isabel Wilkerson, a pleasure to welcome you to Reset. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Chicago. I know it's by phone, but it's great to have you here, bureau chief for the New York Times. So, but where did you come up with the basic premise to look at the caste system for this book?
Well, you know, it started with The Warmth of Other Suns. It is a story of the, you know, out-migration of 6 million African Americans from the Jim Crow South to other parts of the country, most notably Chicago. And in the process of writing that, I came to recognize that this term that anthropologists had used to describe the era of Jim Crow, the world that they were leaving, that the word caste was in some ways the more appropriate and more accurate term to describe the world that they were forced to flee. You know, it was a world where it was actually against the law for a black person and a white person to merely play checkers together in Birmingham, for example. So It became a way of understanding the hierarchy that they were living under, the totalitarian regime, you might say. It was a way of letting us understand a part of our country's history that doesn't make sense in some ways until you find the right language for it. And that's how I came to the idea of caste.
Yeah, that's so true.
To look beyond that.
That's really what it is. It's about language because, as you point out in the book, caste is really the infrastructure of division.
It is. It's the structure that we can't see. You know, that house reference where we can see the wallpaper and the paint and the visible things, but we can't see what's underneath it. We know that it's there. The building wouldn't be standing if it did not have the structure. And yet we often don't look at it. We don't have cause to look at it until something goes wrong. And so the idea of this is kind of holding our country up to the light. It's like an X-ray of our country to see what's beneath it. And I describe, you know, caste is the bones and race is the skin. The skin is what we can see, and that's what's been used as a metric of hierarchy, the tool, the signifier, the cue, the signal of where one has been assigned in this caste system from the very beginning, since, you know, before there was a United States. And it's the thing that we can see. It's the thing that we respond to. But what's underneath it is the infrastructure of why and how this hierarchy was built to begin with.
Yeah, it's as you point, it's a visible decoy for caste, race, and you kind of you talk about race and racism, and you don't discredit it or say that it doesn't exist because it does. But a lot of times we confuse the concepts of race and racism with caste and hierarchy.
Well, I think that it can be useful to see the difference between these two very real concepts. I mean, we're not dealing with generally the classical open racism of our forefathers' era, and we need to acknowledge that. But there has been progress in terms of legislation. After the civil rights movement, we've had, as many people will note, we have had an African American president. So clearly, there have been advances in our country. At the same time, we see this enduring shadow over us is why are these things continuing to happen? Why is it that something that, you know, that the metronome of names, Breonna Taylor and Eric Garner and Tamir Rice before, going back to Trayvon Martin and, of course, now with George Floyd, you know, why are these things continuing to happen? Why is there a wealth gap that's so extreme, not rich gap, but a wealth gap, meaning access to one's resources that goes back to the red redlining and the restrictive covenants that meant that African Americans of the current day are the descendants of people, children and grandchildren of people who had been denied the American dream because they did not, they were excluded from the most basic, you know, part of the American dream, which is to own a home. They were excluded legally and structurally from these things. So why are we still living with the after effects of this? And that's how caste can help us understand that it's a structure underneath what we think we see.
Yeah. Author Isabel Wilkerson's with me, Pulitzer Prize winner and author of the new book, Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents. One of the things to understand caste, the American hierarchy, is to understand how human history has played out, especially in most recent years. You have an anecdote in the book, which is amazing, about Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. just going to India. And,
yeah.
And this concept of the untouchables, explain that to us, because a lot of what is happening in America has happened in other countries, including India.
Yeah, so Dr. Martin Luther King made a journey to India. Of course, he had been inspired by the nonviolent movement led by Mohandas K. Gandhi, and he arrived and was treated like a visiting dignitary. Then he traveled to the South, and he visited a school that had where the students were primarily of what had formerly been known as untouchables, now known as Dalits. And so he, when he arrived there, the principal introduced him to the students and said, "You know, students, I want to introduce you to a fellow untouchable from the United States of America." And when Dr. King heard that language, he bristled at it. He was a bit peeved, in fact, to hear that. He'd had dinner with the Prime Minister.
Right.
He'd been seen as a visiting dignitary. And so he did not see himself in the ways that they apparently were seeing him as a fellow person who was on the bottom of the hierarchy. They recognized what perhaps many of us might not have known. And so he bristled at it at first, and then he thought about it. He realized that at that very moment, African Americans were in the South were not permitted to vote; that they did not have access to the just public facilities, all kinds of differences in terms of access to education. In fact, he was leading a movement to free the people, and he said to himself, "I realize that I am an untouchable, and every black person in America is an untouchable." So Dr. Martin Luther King himself made the connection, saw the connection as a result of the Dalits themselves seeing themselves and their plight in his. He made the connection between that original caste system and ours.
Yeah, it's amazing to hear that story, and of course the juxtaposition of meeting with dignitaries and being an honored guest in the country and going to talk to people and having that play out. But it's not the only time that the American caste system has played. I mentioned earlier just about Nazi Germany, and this was really the part which I just, you know, my jaw dropped. That the idea,
yeah,
that,
mine too.
I mean, talk about the Nuremberg Laws, but the precursor to the Holocaust and what happened in Nazi Germany. There were studies that looked at how the American caste system worked.
Well, I must say that I came to even the only reason I ended up looking at Germany was after Charlottesville, where we saw the symbolism of both the Confederacy and of Nazi Germany merging, and the symbolism and regalia of the protesters who were there to protest the potential removal of the statue of Robert E. Lee. And there we saw these two cultures merging in the mindset and the cries of the people who were protesting. And so that was what led me to Germany to begin with. And there, I was stunned to discover that there had been connections far beyond, going far deeper than I ever would have imagined, that German eugenicists actually were in consultation with and in dialogue with American eugenicists in the years leading up to the Third Reich, that American eugenicists were writing books that were big sellers in Germany and popular among the Nazis in particular. Of course, the Nazis needed no one to teach them how to hate. They did not need anyone to teach them how to hate. And yet they sent researchers to the United States to study the Jim Crow laws, to study the anti-miscegenation laws that were prohibiting people to marry across racial lines. They sent researchers to study the ways that America, particularly in the South, had subjugated African Americans, the laws to segregate state and keep them apart. And they went back and they dated those laws as they were forming what would ultimately become the Nuremberg laws. It was just absolutely chilling and shocking to learn of this.
And it, you know, begs the question about how much we are paying attention to our history to understand that, because I think a lot of Americans who are unwillingly in the caste system that you talk about would like us, would bristle at that concept. They'd be shocked. They'd be surprised. They'd be horrified, embarrassed that Nazi Germany was looking at the American South for better ways to isolate the Jewish population in Germany.
Well, absolutely. I think that this is a reminder that we have so far to go yet to really truly know the full breadth and scope of our own country's history. I mean, after the Warrant for the Sons came out, one of the things that I would hear from people time and time again, regardless of their background or even people whose lives overlapped with the time period covered in the Warrant for the Sons, I would hear the same thing over and over, and that was, I had no idea. They would say, I had no idea these things happened in our country. I had no idea what was going on in the Jim Crow South. I had no idea even about how and why the people had fled to, to the numbers of 6 million people fleeing the Jim Crow South. And so it means that we as a country still have a ways to go to really truly know our own country. If you think about it as an old house, the idea of going in and learning, the history of the house, learning, I describe myself in some ways as a building inspector and writing this book, that I'm going in and looking at the systems and going and looking at the foundation and then providing essentially a report, an x-ray of our country, so that we can better know and understand how we got to where we are.
But that to me is a great metaphor, because so often you'll hear people say, well, it wasn't me. It wasn't my ancestors. I had nothing to do with what happened with slavery or the Jim Crow laws in the South. Why should I? As opposed to if you're a homeowner and you in the wall or the, you know, maybe there's a leak in the pipes or something like that, you rarely are in a position where you're like, well, I didn't cause the leak in the pipes. Like, you have to fix it. You have to say, listen, this is what the house was, but I got to fix it now because I live in it.
Exactly. The thing about it is, if we've inherited this house, so we've got the house now, and we did not build the uneven pillars and joists or whatever it may be that's going on with whatever system. If you have an old house, you know that there's always something that's going to have, that you have to deal with. You know that as soon as you fix one thing, there's something else that may come up. You know that when you are in an older house. And you, again, just as you said, I mean, you don't even necessarily try to figure out, now, which owner before me did this or did that. We are the ones who are living in the house now, and regardless of what might have come before, it is our responsibility now to deal with the current state of the house we're in.
Yeah. Isabel Wilkerson is with me. She's Pulitzer Prize winner, author of the new book, Caste, The Origins of Our Discontent. This story is one that it's a must read. It's a fascinating book. It's outstanding. There's so much we can get into, because it's just every chapter you learn something else about American history. But, you know, I want to ask about religion, because religion plays a role in the American caste system as well. So talk about religion and how religion kind of manifests itself when we're talking about hierarchy and castes.
Well, when in compiling this history that I'm presenting here, I brought together these eight pillars of caste, the eight characteristics that seemed to be consistent among the different hierarchies that I was looking at. And the first one, the foundational one, you might say, is religion, or one might say the laws of nature, the perceived laws of nature, because the idea was important to the people who were the crafters of a hierarchy, that there be a justification for what was ultimately going to be an unequal, high, artificial, arbitrary, graded ranking of human value. And so if everyone was on board, if everyone felt that there was this divine will that indicated or in some ways made it imperative that one group be on top and others be underneath them to serve them or to be enslaved by them, then that would make it easier to convince large groups of people that this was the just thing. This is actually the birthright. And so, in our country, the story of Noah and his three sons, more particularly Ham, who came upon his father unclothed and was thus cursed, and his descendants were cursed to be servants of the others. That was the origin of the justification for slavery, for enslavement, as the founders, as the colonists were forming what would ultimately become a caste system and an infrastructure of division, and to justify the enslavement of the Africans that they were bringing over in order to build the country. And so that was how that was used to justify enslavement for 246 years, and then the subsequent Jim Crow segregation that was afterward.
One of the things I think in the book, too, that grabbed my attention is that you'll hear, when you talk about slavery, that say, well, slavery was, the slave trade was everywhere. This was something that, you know, it's not specific or unique to America. But slavery that was American slavery was an American innovation. Talk about that.
Yeah, this was a kind of slavery that departed from the other kinds of slavery that we might see in ancient Greece and other parts of the world. This was one in which it was inherited, and it was passed down through the mother, which is distinct from other ways of inheriting anything. Usually, inheritance before then was through the father, but because it was through the mother, that meant that any children that woman might have, that African woman might have, whether by another person was enslaved or by the person who claimed to own her, that those children would thus be enslaved, which would mean that there was an economic incentive to actually impregnate the women, African women, at the hands of the enslaver or other people. There was an economic incentive, and this was passed down through generations. So it was 12 generations of people. Imagine how many greats you have to add to the word grandparent, right, to imagine how long it went on, and that there was no escape. You know, in modern day slavery, which often we refer to, if a person manages to escape, then they are escaping to a world that recognizes that slavery is wrong, and they will be, you know, that the enslaver will then be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. But during American slavery, if a person escaped, they were escaping to a world that would return them to slavery, mm-hmm. that slavery was legal, and the person, and they would be the ones punished for trying to free themselves. So there's many, 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 many differences, but that's one of the most profound ones.
Isabel, when we talk about that, because you automatically have an extension to the Jim Crow laws, where even and you understand a little bit more about caste and hierarchy when you talk about the Great Migration, you know, Southern blacks moving to the North for a better opportunity, to be met with the same you know, discrimination, the same racism, everything that was happening in the South was in the North as well. That plays to this idea that there's this hierarchy, there's this caste, that it's not necessarily one state or one plantation. It's more of a countrywide, and in some cases global. But at the end of the day, the question I have is just, you know, when you see that, and you see that kind of that, it makes us better understand what we mean by white privilege, because a lot of people may not understand themselves, being white people, saying, "Well, I don't understand." But there's this, I don't know, this almost this idea that they want to be at the top of this hierarchy and this caste by whatever means necessary.
Well, part of it has to do with understanding what caste is. I mean, caste essentially is an artificial, arbitrary, graded ranking of human value in a society that determines standing and respect, benefits of doubt, access to resources or lack thereof, assumptions of competence, intelligence, and even beauty through no fault or action of one's own. So you do not ask to be born to the top or the bottom. You're born into it. And yet, without you even wanting to, there are entitlements that come to you without you even trying. This is just the way that it is. And the goal here is to allow us to be able to see see underneath what is made invisible, because we've so accustomed to this that we think that this is the way that it always has been. We cannot often see what's underneath because it has been, it's not talked about, we don't recognize it, but you can't fix what you can't see. You can't understand what you don't know, and this is a way to help us to know, help us to be able to see, so that maybe we can see ourselves through a different lens, and then maybe be able to find a new framework in order to heal.
Yeah, what do we need to do as a country to transcend this system? You talk about radical empathy.
I talk about radical empathy because this is a 400-year-old system, a 400-year-old social order that has defied so many efforts to defeat it. You know, the civil rights legislation of the 1860s and 70s. And then the civil rights legislation of the 1960s. So there have been efforts legally in, you know, at tremendous and important and necessary legal changes to forbid the very things that still seem to be with us. So I, you know, it's very clear that despite that very important legislative accomplishments that need to be strengthened, in fact, there's something underneath it that seems to still persist because it's being passed down through the generations. It's like the groundwater that we drink. It's everywhere. The assumptions and recognition of who is expected to be where in a particular place, yeah. Who is supposed to be the CEO in the corner suite, who would be in the mail room, who would be the secretaries, who would be the janitors. Those are the kinds of things that we saw also with COVID-19, where the people who were on the front lines were more likely to be associated with the subordinated caste of what I would call a subordinated caste. And so these are things that we still live with today. The goal would then to be able to try to transcend these artificial boundaries, recognize, first of all, that they're artificial and arbitrary. Once we can see that they're artificial and arbitrary, then we can begin to transcend them and recognize that we all have so much more in common than we've been led to believe, that we truly are, you know, want the same things. People want the same thing for their children. They want to, you know, to be successful in their career. They want to live out their talents and their gifts while they during their time on this planet. And if we could begin to see that we have so much more in common, that we are actually one species, and that we these divisions are arbitrary and have been so destructive to everyone. I mean, one of the things that I talk about in this book is the ways in which this is destructive, yeah, for all of us, ways that we might not otherwise see, in hopes that we can surpass, you know, somehow transcend this for the betterment of ourselves and our society and for the species and the planet.
Such a fascinating book. Isabel Wilkerson, Pulitzer Prize winner, author of the new book, Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents, also the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration, which I also recommend checking out. Isabel, thank you so much for taking time to join us and talk today, and appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you so much.